two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Other headlines continue to center around the debt ceiling battle between the White House and Republicans in the House of Representatives. The members of Congress mostly have flown home for the weekend, the long holiday weekend. President Biden has said the edge of the debt limit cliff will arrive June 1st, months after the U.S. actually already hit the debt limit. We'll talk about that later. News media have focused headlines on the terrifying possibilities, what happens if there is a debt default, which really hasn't happened. We don't do that. And so the bigger question is, where are we in the process, not the panic? Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
I get it. Panic sales and panic gets clicks, but we're not going to panic. We've been describing the process for several months now in terms of where we actually are as it relates to the debt ceiling. And it's important to recognize, even in just any negotiation process, this has pretty much followed it almost to the T. And that is, you have an initial meeting with the two principals, in this case, the Speaker of the House and the President of the United States. After that meeting, there's a lot of rhetoric. They decide staff will then meet. That happens for a few days. The two principals get back together in the Oval Office. They come back. They each appoint specific negotiators and representatives, a very small group. They work at it for a few days. There's usually some drama partway through that negotiation process. One of the sides or both choose to walk away from the table. We had that. Then they get back to the table, which happened over the weekend last weekend. And then they kind of plod their way through and then ultimately get down to a narrowing of the deal. And I think that's where we are. We're on Friday now. And my guess is, based on what I'm hearing coming out of Washington, is there's a pretty decent framework and some pretty strong agreement on a number of the pieces of the puzzle. And if I had to place my bets on all of this, my guess is that sometime tomorrow, could be as early as tomorrow morning, that you will hear about a deal that has been struck. And then they'll work on the legislative text, then they'll have to have votes. And we'll get into that as we move along. So this morning, Speaker McCarthy, as he's been very focused on and leaning into over the last several weeks, had a little gaggle of reporters as he came into the Capitol this morning. And he talked about, importantly, the final negotiations, what they're coming down to.
It's really coming down to one thing. This has been about spending. The Democrats have never wanted to stop the amount of spending that they're going. They want to just keep adding and adding and adding. I do not think it's right that you borrow money from China to pay people to stay home that are able-bodied with no dependents on the couch.
Speaker McCarthy also talked about some of the rumbling and grumblings that are starting to come out. And this is an interesting part of this whole process. The moment you start hearing grumblings from the far right or the far left, that means that a deal is pretty close because they're starting to hear what they think the specifics of the deal will be. So for Speaker McCarthy, to his flank is the House Freedom Caucus. And there have been rumblings that the House Freedom Caucus is not yet on board with what could be the deal.
You're talking to people who don't know what's in the deal. So I'm not concerned about anybody making any comments right now about what they think is in or not in. Whenever we come to an agreement, we'll make sure we will first brief our entire conference.
And so that's an important part. Often you get these members of Congress who aren't in the room where it's happening, but they still want to rush to a camera to make a comment or to try to get a social media moment. And so they're commenting on, oh, this isn't going to happen. I'm going to vote no on that. And they don't know what's in the deal yet. And so you have to be careful of that. I think both sides, both the Democrats and the Republican negotiators, were actually very happy when they put the House into recess yesterday. The best thing for the negotiators, get the members of Congress out of town, except for those that have to be there in the room. And so that has been done. Most of the members of Congress have gone back to their districts for the Memorial Day weekend. Interesting, in a press conference yesterday, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries was asked if he could support a deal which included things they said they didn't want in there, spending cuts.
It's clear to me that President Biden is continuing to hold the line as it relates to the types of devastating cuts that Republicans are trying to jam down the throats of the American people, including making sure that he stands up for our veterans.
Now, Jeffries went on to say that he believes Republicans think a default would actually be a good thing for them politically.
But what is clear to me increasingly is that many extreme MAGA Republicans have made the political calculation that a dangerous default and crashing the economy and triggering a recession is in their political interests.
And that's the point where I disagree with Hakeem Jeffries. And again, you've heard similar things coming out of the right wing of the Republican Party as well, in terms of who wants what and who is racing to disaster faster. All of those kinds of political rhetoric things are coming from both sides. I didn't think Hakeem Jeffries would go down that path, but he did yesterday just a little bit. But here was an interesting thing. This was actually a little earlier in the week. And I think this was an important question for Hakeem Jeffries. This is the first big test he's had as minority leader in the House. He was asked a question about why Democrats didn't raise the debt ceiling when the Democrats were in control of the House, the Senate, and the White House back in December of last year.
Do you have regrets that your party did not raise the debt ceiling when it was in the majority?
It's not... my understanding that the challenge was not addressing the debt ceiling because Democrats refused to do it. But it's my understanding that Republicans in the Senate were unwilling to discuss this issue last December, perhaps because they wanted to set up a hostage-taking situation.
All right. Now, that's you could tell that caught Leader Jeffries off guard. He was not ready to answer that question. He should have been ready to answer that question from the Democratic side, because they didn't need any Republican votes on that one because of the type of bill that it was. They could have just done that with a 50-vote majority. And so that was a very interesting thing, a little bit of a misstep for Hakeem Jeffries. And again, he's trying to navigate and keep his caucus together, the Democrats together. And again, he's doing this for the first time. And so there's a lot of uncertainties there as well. Now, before we set this aside for a bit, I want to dig into just the panic versus the process. Yesterday, we had our good friend James Wallner from the R Street Institute on, and we were talking about this X date, June the 1st, and everyone is framing that is when we're going to break through the debt ceiling. And James reminded us correctly that we already are there.
Well, the first thing is that the government hit its debt limit back in January, but we've been able to continue to fund our activities and pay interest on our current debt, which is $31.4 trillion, by employing a series of so-called extraordinary measures. And those measures are going to run out in June. And so if Congress doesn't raise the debt by the time those measures run out, it will have to operate on incoming revenue, which there is incoming revenue, and it'll have to choose what to use that incoming revenue to do, because it's not enough to pay for everything. And what we know it will do based on what administration officials in the past have testified before Congress about, is it will use that incoming revenue to pay interest on the debt because it doesn't want to default. And we're not going to default because we have more than enough revenue to pay interest on the debt. And then it will delay payments to the guy who cuts the grass on the National Mall, to congressional staffers, to others in the federal government and other kinds of activities that the federal government spends money on. You're not going to be able to buy, you know, a bunch of office supplies potentially if we hit the debt limit and we have to operate on incoming revenue for a while.
All right. So that's an important thing. We hit the debt limit in January. We've just been using incoming revenue to pay for what's going on. It gets harder come June 1st. Just like for your own family, you probably have a lot of bills that are due on the first of each month. The federal government's the same. It's got a lot of bills that they have to pay at the first of the month. But as you go through the month, there's still money coming into the Treasury every day. Now, you're asking, where does that come from? It's business taxes. It's small business taxes. It's individuals who are filing as sole proprietors and have to make estimated payments every quarter. So there's always money coming into the government. And it's just those first few days of the month that are hardest for the government to cover. Then you get through the month and money keeps coming in and there's not a lot of bills left to pay and things are all right. Now, we don't want to get to that point, obviously, because that can put some things at risk that would be scary, that would be dangerous for the security of the country. But I'm glad that James reminded us that, one, we've already hit the debt limit. We blew past it at a million miles an hour in January. And so now this next phase is an important part. And just quickly, President Biden said that he was confident that the congressional leaders' promise that there will be no default is legit and that the negotiations are about the spending and the budget.
It is time for Congress to act now. Now, I want to be clear that the negotiations we're having with Speaker McCarthy is about the outlines of what the budget will look like, not about default. It's about competing visions for America. Under my administration, we've already cut the deficit by $1.7 trillion in our first 2 years. But Speaker McCarthy and I have a very different view of who should bear the burden of additional efforts to get our fiscal house in order.
Lots to be done, lots of work yet to do, and I think it will get done. I think we'll hear the framing and specifics of a deal starting tomorrow morning by midday at the latest. Then they'll have to work through legislative language, give members of Congress an opportunity to read it. I love that they're actually going to give them time to read it. And then my guess is Tuesday evening of next week, there'll be a vote in the House. They'll kick it over to the Senate, who will get it done and pass it on to the president. So don't panic. It's a process, and the process rolls on, and we're all going to be just fine in the end.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen.
Boyd Matheson divides rage from reason on Inside Sources.
Well, it's graduation season, of course, and we always do a little look at some of the unique commencement speeches that are delivered around the country. And here's a unique one for you. The graduating class at Johns Hopkins University had a surprising guest deliver the commencement speech this week. Ukrainian President Zelensky was on tap. President Zelensky appeared on a big screen speaking to the graduates from Kyiv. And the message he sent was maybe a little surprise. It was definitely a think again moment, I think, for some of those graduates. It wasn't about war. It wasn't about great leadership. It wasn't about conflict. It wasn't about oppression. It was about the essence of time. President Zelensky said that the most valuable resource isn't oil or minerals.
Time is the most valuable resource on the planet, not oil or uranium, not lithium or anything else, but time. Time. The very flow of time convinces us of this.
That very flow of time shows that it really is the most priceless commodity that we have on the planet. And just imagine that. I would have loved to have been in the room when he was crafting this speech in a war zone with everything going on around him, both in his own country and around the world and all that was taking place. And he has been one that has talked a lot about time and the essence for speed, while some of the help and aid and weaponry was very slow to come. It's always been about time when it comes to President Zelensky. He said that he recently spent time on the front lines of the war effort, and he told the graduates that the Ukrainian soldiers, have a lot in common with those graduating students, but there are also some differences as well.
The front in Ukraine consists of very, very different people who are fighting for freedom and independence. These are people of all ages, and among them are exactly the same folks as you are now. Some of them have already passed their graduation ceremony. Others are only dreaming about it. They and you have similar hopes for life, similar expectations from life. But there is a fundamental difference that comes down to the question of time. The time of your life is under your control.
He talked about how the Ukrainians don't have control of their lives right now because of the Russian invasion. He went from talking about time and how crucial and critical it is that we don't squander it or waste it. He also talked about some specific advice for the graduates to have a vision for what they want their life to become.
You have to know exactly why you need today and how you want your tomorrows to look like. You have to know this when you are a politician and have to achieve a certain goal for your country. You have to know this when you are a soldier and you have to defend your position so that the whole country is protected. You have to know this when you just have to go through life.
Importantly, the president of Ukraine went on to say that the struggle in Ukraine is so similar to the struggle during World War II and the struggles that really have taken place over time, that it is a battle between freedom and tyranny.
President Biden, a strong bipartisan coalition in Congress, and most of all the American people have, like the generations before them, risen to this occasion and are leading the free world to secure freedom in Europe. We Ukrainians believe that free and secure Ukraine is the final step in the struggle to liberate Europe from the evil of tyrannies. This struggle that brought your great-grandparents to the shores of northern France some 80 years ago.
I loved how President Zelensky connected those that are fighting on the front lines of Ukraine in the battle against Russia today actually have a lot in common with those graduating students from Johns Hopkins University with their great-grandparents. He said that these were the same things, this battle of good and evil, this freedom versus tyranny, is the same struggle that brought these students' great-grandparents to the northern shores of France 80 years ago. I love how he connected that. And so if you look at that from the top of his speech, yet looking at this essence of time and what a valuable resource it is and how we have to be very careful about our choices in how we use our time. Everyone gets the same amount. And I'm actually one of those who believes there's no such thing as time management. You really can't manage time. Manage means you're going to hold it, mold it, shape it or form it, influence it, control it or have direct, direct control over it. And you can't do that with time. You can't hold time or shape it or form it or save it for tomorrow. And so what that leaves you with is choice management. And President Zelensky was telling the graduates, be careful of your choices and make sure you have a vision of what you want those choices to produce in terms of results. That way your time will be well spent and your life will be well lived. And then he concluded by saying that a future without tyranny and all of our tomorrows really depends on those very choices that we make today.
I'm certain you, as your forefathers, will continue to lead the free world, and this century will be our century, a century where freedom, innovation, and democratic values reign, a century where tyrannies that repress their own and seek to enslave their neighbors will vanish from us once and for all. But all of our tomorrows and the tomorrows of our children and grandchildren depends on each of our todays.
Pretty stirring speech from the president of Ukraine to the graduate at Johns Hopkins University. Definitely had to be an interesting look up there on the screen to find somebody in the middle of a war zone delivering a graduation speech. That's called speaking under pressure, a different kind of pressure. But I love the themes that President Zelensky wove together, and he's proven time and again that he is a master of the moment. He understands how to craft and shape a message in ways that are powerful and highly impactful. And I can't imagine that there was a graduate in the audience there that didn't feel something a little bit different than maybe they had expected going into their graduation exercises. And I think it's a good message for all of us, especially rolling into a Memorial Day weekend, that it is about time. None of us know how much we have or when that time might be cut short. And so we better use it and use it well. We better use it with a vision for the future and the things that we desire most. And we better make sure that freedom is part of the equation. Because in the absence of freedom, in the absence of choice, life is pretty dreary. Under a dictator, under an empire that is pursuing and invading and breaching the sovereignty of other nations, there is very little choice, and there is no vision in terms of what comes next. And Vladimir, Zelensky has given a vision to the people of Ukraine, and this week to the graduates of Johns Hopkins University, of what that actually should look like. So choices matter. All right, we'll step aside for some bottom of the hour news. Much more to come on Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. We'll talk about this longing for belonging, this need to connect, and how we do that in the workplace. Coming up next, stick around.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
We have been talking at some length over the course of the past month about the longing for belonging, that craving to be connected to something bigger than ourselves. And often we think about that in the sense of family or neighborhood or community. But we've also touched on it in terms of business. You may remember a conversation we had a little bit ago with Kimberly Serrano from the Immigration Council. And we decided to extend that conversation and bring it right here home to the state of Utah on the business level. And we have to recognize that businesses across the country and here in the state of Utah are always trying to figure out, how do you help employees have a better experience at work? Well, one Utah organization, the Center for Economic Opportunity and Belonging, has released a new digital toolkit available to all Utah employers that aims to increase that sense of belonging in the workplace. And so we're going to talk about some of those tools. And to help us do that today, we're really thrilled. We have Ziming Sao, is the director at the Center for Economic Opportunity and Belonging. And we also have Scott Cuthbertson, who's the CEO of EDC Utah. And welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Boyd. It's
great to be here.
And Z, let me start with you. Give us a sense of what's happening here in the state of Utah. What are you doing at the Center for Economic Opportunity and Belonging?
Yeah, we found that belonging is such an incredibly important issue for the whole entire state, but particularly with the workplaces. Study have found that workplaces is really a place where you meet people from diverse cultures and traditions, and just a really great place where you can build a bond with each other. And to promote that, we want to build toolkits to help local businesses to be able to do that and encourage the sense of building belongings both inside the businesses as well as outside the community.
Yeah, and we'll talk about some of the specifics of the toolkit in just a minute. But Z, let me ask you, it's been really interesting, obviously, over the course of the pandemic, and now we sort of have these really hybrid kind of situations, some home, some at work, some 2 days a week, and lots of variations. And so that connectivity isn't quite as consistent as it used to be. What are you seeing out there?
I think that that is absolutely true. We're seeing a lot of disconnects because of the new models of how we operate businesses. We have hybrid models, we have remote models. And what we found is that the importance of building those intentionalities, of grouping people together, becomes even more important. Whereas in the past, we might be able to see each other in the work in your lunchrooms and be able to chat with each other. That might not be the case anymore. So for businesses to think about how do we bring think about strategies in bringing employees together so that they can build a sense of belonging and build a sense of connectivities and build a community, right? At the heart of belonging is really building those connections, relationships, so that we are a stronger community together.
Everybody wants to be part of a story. Everyone wants to be part of a story, and I think that's so important. I know some of the toolkit elements are part of that. Scott, I want to jump over to you and talk about EDC Utah's involvement in this. This is an extraordinary project that seems to really have some legs underneath it and a really bright future. Tell us about it.
Yeah, happy to, Boyd. And, you know, as he was talking there about this kind of acute need for a sense of belonging, we stood up this entity, the Center for Economic Opportunity and Belonging, because we saw a need coming kind of years in the works. We're focused on economic development. We're focused on economic development. We also do quite a bit of corporate interfacing. Mm-hmm. When companies are looking at coming to Utah, we're kind of the front door. We offer them that concierge service, provide them with research and data about Utah. And what we saw was there were some companies who were concerned about their employees coming to a state where there was at least a perception of not having cultures like those they belong to.
Yeah.
So we saw that and we looked across what we could do in terms of our mission and came up with the idea for the Center of Economic Opportunity and Belonging about 2 years ago, and it's been a great success. This toolkit is just one of a number of different tools that employers, both coming into the state and those that are in the state currently, mm-hmm. can use to understand how do they reach employees of different belongings, how do they interact with them, how can they make them feel like they're part of the team, and to really help kind of bridge that gap. And we think it's been hugely successful so far.
Yeah. As you look at that, Scott, I'm going to ask you this. I'm going to ask you this question as well, that ability to bring your whole authentic self to work and bringing your faith and your ethnicity and your passions and all of that to the workplace. How are the businesses that are doing this right and doing it well? What are they doing that is fostering that?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think it's understanding about the backgrounds of their employees. Mm. It's creating opportunities for them to express what they're feeling, to share who they are with others without being judged.
Yeah.
Something that we try to do internally within EDC Utah as part of our own culture. And I think if I could just add why it's so important, if you need a reason other than it seems like the right thing to do, the business benefits are palpable. Mm-hmm. So there are a number of studies out there. Boston Consulting Group, a study that showed that those employers with diverse workforces have 19% more revenue than those that are mm-hmm. less diverse. In terms of retention, 50% higher. In terms of sick days, 75% mm-hmm. fewer sick days used for companies that have a culture of belonging. So it's pretty dramatic and pretty clear.
Yeah, that brings it right to the bottom line, and it brings it to the people which deliver that bottom line. I actually love that. Z, what are you seeing?
Yeah, absolutely. And that bottom line is important, but I want to talk about, you know, this is the right thing to do as well, right? I think this is why it so resonates with so many companies in the state and elsewhere. It's the right thing to do, and it helps the bottom line. And in terms of the right thing to do, not only does it help create a better bottom line, but your employees are happier.
Yeah.
And when you have a happier employee and they feel like they belong there, I mean, that adds to a lot of productivity as well. And I think that element of just investing. And the fact is that it doesn't really cost that much, right?
Yeah.
If you do it right. And I think one thing we want to iterate, and the reason why we provided and created this toolkit, is that you can start somewhere.
Yeah.
This is the toolkit provides a pathway for companies to get started. You don't have to start all the way into the premium version.
Yeah.
You don't have to hire, you know, two employees dedicated to this, right? You can start. We want to meet companies where they are and provide those very tactical things that you can do. So in the toolkit, we lay out a couple of steps. The first and I think most important step is leadership, right?
Mm-hmm.
How can leadership demonstrate and show support that this is the right thing to do
and
make a commitment in doing it? So we provide examples.
Yeah.
This, if you're a company and you're interested and this is important to you, you know, write a statement about why you believe in this, mm-hmm. making sure that you issue a statement to your employees saying that this is an important value to a company, right? And then we provide very tactical things. What can you do after you do that, right?
Yeah.
How do you promote the sense of getting your employees together? Whether that is just, you know, having an activity in mm-hmm. your company that brings people together. And like we talk about this. How do we create that magic when we have, when we're in the lunchrooms?
Yeah.
Even though people are not having lunches together, you can still create that magic.
That's right.
What is that strategy?
So important.
Yeah.
Yeah, so good. And where can people find the toolkit? Where do they need to look?
So the individuals could and businesses could go to the EDC Utah website, so edcutah.org, okay. and they could download the toolkit, and it's free.
Oh, wow. All of the things. So, Z, you pointed out some really important things, especially if you're a small or medium-sized business and you're worried that this sounds really expensive. Most of the things that create belonging and connection cost almost nothing. Some of it does cost nothing, but it does always take leadership. It's always a leadership question, and I love that you framed it that way. I think that's so important for leaders, regardless of the size of the company or the organization or the community, by the way. I think it applies to community as well. If you're going to lead and create that kind of statement and vision to create space for people to belong and feel connected is a powerful thing. Scott, before we let you go for the Memorial Day weekend, give us your thought in terms of the vision of what's next. How do you continue this this mantra, this march, and this crucial part of EDC Utah?
Yeah. So, you know, the Center for Belonging has been really successful the last 2 years, and they're actually going to be graduating from EDC Utah, and that's a conscious move to allow them to kind of spread their wings.
Yeah.
Frankly, we can't keep pace with them. There's so much momentum and so much of an appetite out there for belonging.
I think Z's the Energizer Bunny.
She is. She's dynamic and doing a great job. But I think as we look forward, we're going to stay closely connected with them. We're going to continue to promote these values. As we look across Utah as a state and the growth trends that we're seeing, you know, 1 in 3 Utahns in the future will identify as being from a multicultural background. It's 1 in 4 right now.
Yeah.
The next 10, 20 years or so, it's going to become increasingly more important to be able to reach people of different backgrounds, and we're going to be out helping to support them.
Yeah, that's fantastic. So grateful to have both of you in studio today. We're going to have you back. This is just the beginning of this conversation. It's a crucial one. Z. Sal is the director at the Center for Economic Opportunity and Belonging. And Scott Cuthbertson, of course, is the CEO of EDC Utah. Grateful to have both of you in. And everyone, again, you can check out that toolkit. Create that sense of belonging and connectivity in your organization. EDCUtah.org is the place to check that out. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
We'll go ahead and step aside for a quick break. When we come back, it's that time of the week, the inside look at the inside sources of the inside track of 2024 presidential politics. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Inside sources, an inside look at 2024 presidential politics.
Well, it's that time of the week. Inside sources, inside look at the presidential race for 2024. And we'll do our precursor that trying to understand the behavior of someone running for president is like trying to smell the color 7. So you can think about that as you're driving along. The crowded field for the Republican primary is getting more crowded. Two new candidates made it official in their announcements for running for president this week. Each candidate faces a challenge. How do you differentiate? How do you take on the former president who seems to be leading the field? How do you do that without alienating bases or critical alliances that you'll need to have to run the table to actually get the nomination? This tends to lead people to point fingers, point out flaws, do personal attacks, all the things that we dislike about our politics. So can this group of candidates avoid what in the past has seemed to be the inevitable? Of going to the lowest common denominator in their communication. So let's take a look at how things played out this week. After a very rocky, glitch-filled announcement on Twitter that he was running for president of Florida, Governor Ron DeSantis joined Trey Gowdy on Fox News for an interview later that same night. I think it was sort of the saving grace of the evening for the Florida governor. He gave his pitch for president to the cable news audience. Here's what he had to say.
We see the federal government making it more difficult for families to make ends meet, and we have a president who is a listless vessel, not energetic, and not dealing with the key challenges that are facing our country. But it does not have to be this way. Our decline as a country is not inevitable. It is a choice. And I think we can choose a better pathway. And so what I will do is help restore normalcy to our communities, integrity to our institutions, and sanity to our society. Truth needs to be the foundation of everything we do, and common sense can no longer be an uncommon virtue. We need to win again as Republicans. We got to dispense with this culture of losing.
So I think this was one of the better moments that Ron DeSantis had on his announcement day. He was able to get to some of the things, spend a little time poking at the president and getting down to that more divisive language, but quickly pivoted back to the fact that American decline is not inevitable. It's a choice. We have to choose different. Talked about the need for common sense to not be an uncommon virtue anymore, especially in Congress. So I think he did okay in that space. I think that was a pretty good moment for the Florida governor. Now, I want to shift to a candidate that you probably haven't heard a whole lot about, former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson. He's in the race, and he's one of the few candidates to look at specific examples of policy differences that he has with former President Donald Trump in the Republican primary. I think that's a very interesting space. It's not about just tossing insults back and forth or pejoratives back and forth. He's saying we should talk about the policy differences back and forth. So here's what former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson had to say during a recent interview about where he and Trump disagree on policy.
Well, I think he did a good job in many areas, but there's also areas that I disagree with him on. I think he created too much turmoil on the world stage. I think how he negotiated with the Taliban was an error. I think spending is a problem. I think there's a responsibility both on Republican and Democrat side for the fact that we have a $31 trillion deficit today. I do believe it's time for new leadership and new ideas.
I think that's really important from Asa Hutchinson. Again, doesn't have a lot of traction, doesn't have a lot of money behind him, but that's an important conversation right there. Here's the differences I have with former President Trump in terms of policy. He talked about negotiating with the Taliban. He talked about a spending problem that he said both sides are responsible for. I think he got that point right for sure, and that we don't need as much turmoil on the world stage. So some pretty interesting things there. Again, hard for Asa Hutchinson to get a lot of traction with all the chatter and clamor out there, but he's one that is worth listening to. He is one of those that will call out both sides when he needs to. Now, Nikki Haley has been in the race for quite a while. She was asked to give her reaction to Ron DeSantis entering the race during a recent interview on Fox News. She called him out for attempting to be a copy of Donald Trump, down to copying his hand gestures.
I'm just mentioning what everybody else is saying. I mean, you look at the fact that the way he speaks, the way his hand gestures are, the fact that he's moved his policies, whether it's Ukraine and Russia, to entitlement reform, he's done a total 180. All of it's copying Trump. He needs to be his own person. He needs to get out there and say what he believes, what he thinks. If he's just going to be an echo to Trump, people just vote for Trump. Why doesn't he go out there? I'm my own person. You're going to see what you see is what you get. I'm going to tell you what I think. I'm going to tell you what I believe. And I'm going to let the chips fall where they may. He should do the same thing.
So very interesting. Now, that was a difficult point because she was asked specifically to comment on what was going on or what had just happened with Ron DeSantis. I don't know that that's the best place for Nikki Haley, but I thought she did say some interesting things in the context of all of that. She obviously was saying that, look, this is just a different version. Our friend George Will from The Washington Post had an interesting comparison to Ron DeSantis being Coke Zero to Donald Trump being Coke Classic, and why those who love Coke hated Coke Zero and those who didn't like Coke didn't like either and didn't change. And it was a short-lived experiment. So interesting coming out of Nikki Haley that an echo is not what we need. We need something different. And so clearly that's where she is going to try to differentiate. That's an important part of this whole process. Again, regardless of how much you like one candidate or the other, that's kind of the strategy that Nikki Haley has to get, is to a differentiation lane. That's the key component. And then finally, yesterday, newly announced presidential candidate Tim Scott gave an interview to Neil Cavuto on Fox Business, laying out the case for why he should be the next president. And he warned that a divided Republican Party is a weak Republican Party, and that the focus should be the faltering leadership on the other side.
Well, I think the road to socialism runs right through a divided Republican Party. Everything we say about each other, the Democrats will weaponize against all of us, no matter who the nominee is. I'm going to focus on the real problem in America. The real problem in America is the feckless leadership of Joe Biden. We cannot just continue to look to your left and right on who's on the stage and attack vehemently those who want to represent the greatest conservative party in modern American history. That's the Great Opportunity Party. If we do what we're supposed to do, America agrees with us on the economy, on the military, on foreign policy. But we have not had the candidate that adds to the movement. Today, we have to stop dividing the movement.
So very interesting there from Senator Tim Scott, one of the newer candidates in the field. Road to socialism runs through a divided Republican Party. That's an interesting phrase to really dig into. He talked about the real problems and that the worst thing that anybody can do is just point fingers and place blame because that doesn't work. So really interesting. We'll look at some of the Democratic side next week in terms of where the president is and those that are challenging him. Two very small candidates in against President Biden right now. So we'll hit that next week. And that's what we do every week here on Friday, looking at the Inside Sources Inside Look at Presidential Politics. And that wraps up hour number one of Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. We got a big hour number two coming up next. You don't want to go anywhere. Jenny Taylor is going to join us, talk about Memorial Day, what we should be thinking about and talking about coming up next. Stick around.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, Utah's all-day companion for news. Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, as we roll into the Memorial Day weekend, you may be focused on that family barbecue or pool party or those holiday deals online. But before you look forward to those things, I think it's very important for us to take a moment and step back and look back at the men and women who gave their lives so that we can enjoy and pursue our own freedoms. So how should we remember and honor them as we move into the weekend? As always, we need to do it just a little bit beyond the headlines. Let's dig a little deeper. Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, if we lose our ability to remember, we're in danger of losing a whole lot more. We've said that often on this program, and especially as we roll into Memorial Day weekend, we're really pleased to have back on the program Jenny Taylor, founder of the Major Brent Taylor Foundation. She's the co-host of the KSL podcast, Relentlessly Resilient, a Gold Star widow and mom, an extraordinary family. And Jenny, welcome back to the show.
Always great to be with you, Boyd.
You've already had a busy Memorial Day weekend. Tell us what you've been doing today.
So we kick it off strong. We've had a couple opportunities to join the residents of some of Utah's veterans' homes, so the assisted living centers for our veterans. There's one in Ogden, one in Salt Lake, another in Payson and St. George. And I was able to speak at two of those yesterday and today and just pause. You know, I'm preaching to the choir with those people, but to pause and remember, reflect, look back, like you said, on their generation, Korea, Vietnam, and just come together and remember that a very heavy price has been paid by previous generations so that our generation can chase the dreams that the American dream affords each of us.
Yeah, absolutely. And you had a piece published today talking about this Global War on Terrorism Memorial Foundation. Tell us about that.
So it's really exciting. The Global War on Terrorism, of course, was the 20-year war from 2001 to 2021, and there is a national foundation that has been given the congressional assignment of creating a monument to this war and those who fought and died in it on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. So it's a few years out before it'll be ready and dedicated. It's in a lot of the planning and design phases, but it's been great. There's several of us that are from the Gold Star community from that war that get to sit in on some of the conversations and have a look at maybe how they're going about this process and really just lend some of the stories and faces to this 20 years, over 7,000 killed, and of course, tens of thousands that served, if not over hundreds of thousands that served in that 20-year period.
So important. And to have that on the National Mall, I think, is so important because this wasn't a conventional war with a real specific beginning and end and everything in between. It has been so long and so varied that I think it's easy to forget about it or to not quite understand its place in our history and the path of freedom. So tell us a little bit, as you've been working that through with the foundation and looking at what that might look like on the National Mall, what are some of the things that are coming forward in terms of how do you tell that story?
Well, you know, like you said, it's a lot of stories to tell because of the sheer length of the war. I mean, Vietnam and Korea were also very long wars. I think we'll see some exciting things with this monument, taking into account some of the technology that we have. You know, there's artifacts for the Vietnam Wall in particular where people will go visit that wall and maybe they take a rose or a watch or a picture. I think sometimes there's a video somewhere of someone that left his Harley to honor his friend. And then where do you put those things? You know, where do you store that? In today's world, a lot of today's museum exhibits and monuments can use the virtual space. Maybe there's some kind of kiosk, some kind of digital. Now, like, I don't want to get ahead of myself because the design, I'm going to get in big trouble. The design is not even done, I promise you. But I will tell you, it will beautifully honor, really, it's a generational war that actually bridged generations. There are several stories of father and son or mother and daughter or vice versa where the parent and the child served in the same war. Different countries involved in this war, different battles, quote unquote, that were there. It will honor those who died in the war and also those who served and were willing to die. And the one thing that I love about this that just touches my heart so much is the fact that Congress has given the okay for it to be done now. The World War II monument in D.C. is beautiful and touching, and I love that we've been able to take veterans out there. But we took most of them in wheelchairs and on oxygen tanks.
Yeah.
And so I'm grateful that a lot of the men and women who served in what we affectionately call the GWAT, the Global War on Terrorism, you know, they're in their 40s or 50s, if not younger than that. And so if it takes a few more years to finish, they're still able to go. And organizations like Honor Flight take veterans to those beautiful monuments appropriately placed on the National Mall in our nation's capital. This war and its warfighters will be honored right among those of wars of previous generations. And I'm excited that it will happen in a time frame in which hopefully the living survivors from that war and their family members will have the opportunity to go see it before the physicality of getting too old makes it too hard.
That is so important and so powerful to do that. And I know you're actually working on some plans to do kind of a honor flight style travel experience for some of those from the Global War on Terror. Give us a little vision of what that might look like.
We have kind of our own spin on Honor Flight, and we have been working with Utah's chapter of Honor Flight, and they have been fabulous to work with. Our goal is to focus on the families of the fallen, particularly from this GWAT, the Global War on Terrorism. Right now, already, there is a beautiful memorial monument in Georgia. Most people in the Army world would know it as Fort Benning, but just last a couple weeks ago, it was changed to Fort Moore. But Fort Benning, Fort Moore, Georgia is home to this beautiful monument. And Boyd, there's granite slabs with the names of every man or woman that has died overseas during that 20-year war. And of those 7,000, we've identified over 75 of those names that have immediate family ties here in Utah.
Oh,
so our goal we're working on, and I hope your listeners will help me, we want to find the families of those fallen, those who died in Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, those who served overseas and died either in theater, which is the military term for, you know, over in the battle area, or as a direct result of injuries sustained in theater. Their name is on the wall. It's in Georgia. We want to pay for their travel to come with us this September, the weekend leading up to September 11th, and we want to go together. Think of this as a family field trip for the Gold Star members of this generation. I need the moms.
Wow.
I need the sisters. I need the brothers, the wives, the dads. If anyone's listening and knows family members who might fall into that category, you can email us at info@MajorBrentTaylor.com. You can go to our website, MajorBrentTaylor.com, and there's a little video and some information about it. Beautiful memorial, very well put together. Again, this is at Fort Benning, or now known as Fort Moore, at the home of the National Infantry Museum. we're hopeful that in 4 or 5 years after the Washington, D.C. monument is in place, we'll pivot and start taking families to the nation's capital. But no need to wait. These people have already paid the ultimate sacrifices, a son, a brother, a daughter, a mother. We want them to have the healing opportunity to touch their name on a wall. Boyd, I can't tell you. And you know, I've seen it in movies before. We've watched someone else do it. They get a little piece of paper and a crayon and etch the name. I've done that with my husband's name. My mother-in-law has done that with her son's name. We've seen friends touch their daughter's name or their sister's name. It is so powerful, and we want to share that with the other families in Utah who have names on that wall.
So powerful. And if anyone listening, if you have any connection or any insight there, give them the website and the information one more time, Jenny.
Yep. The website itself is majorbrenttaylor.com. There's two T's between Brent and Taylor. Or the email is info@majorbrenttaylor.com. Or just go find me on social media if you're on Facebook or Instagram, and let's connect. We would love to take their family, and we mean their family. I don't mean just the wife or just the mom. Of course, I'm saying just in air quotes. We want the family. Are you the brother? Are you the child? Are you the sibling? Let's get you out there.
Fantastic. And rolling into this Memorial Day weekend, Jenny, as always, we thank you for your service. And anyone listening, if you have ever doubted the power and the difference that one person can make, that then becomes 10 people, that then becomes 100, that then becomes 1,000, that then becomes a movement, Jenny Taylor is the embodiment of what that looks like. And Jenny, we love your leadership. We appreciate what you do for all of those Gold Star families, for all in the military community, and for all of us. You help all of us to raise our sights a little higher, to make our patriotism run just a little bit deeper and our hope for the future just a little bit stronger. Thanks for joining us today.
Such an honor, Boyd. Thank you.
All right, that's Jenny Taylor from the Major Brent Taylor Foundation. And nothing's more important. We're going to come back to this idea of remembering. Nothing's more important. And if we lose our ability to remember, especially things that really matter, like Memorial Day, we truly are in danger of losing a great deal more. And so as you roll into this weekend, make sure, amidst all the other things, carve out a little time to just be still and remember. We'll be right back.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Get deeper insights on the news from Inside Sources.
Well, this month we've discussed loneliness, resiliency, the importance of talking about mental health. So as we round out Mental Health Awareness Month, we have a very special guest joining us on the show today. She's someone who's seen firsthand the heartbreaking effects of poor mental health, of what it takes to be resilient. Ganalyn Conde is a motivational speaker. She's the host of Talk of Him and The Middle. She's the author and mental health advocate and 27,000 other things that we won't list today, or we won't get to a conversation. And Ganalyn, welcome back to the program.
It's so good to be here and be in studio and have this conversation with someone I love to have conversations with.
Oh, well, let's jump in. It is Mental Health Awareness. You have a lot of history in here as an advocate. Give us kind of a broad brush. You've been watching this play out over the course of the month and the different conversations. What have we been missing in our conversations?
Well, first and foremost, I would say that for me in this space, after 9+ years of really like full time having conversations, we're having better conversations. And I think there's very few areas of life where we say, hey, we're doing better at that. So I just want to first and foremost say the fact, the volume of conversations and the quantity of conversations to me give me hope. From 9 years ago, where when my sister died by suicide, it felt like sometimes an echo chamber. And now I feel like there's a lot of voices, and they're coming at it from perspectives that I think are nuanced. And I think when we talk about mental health, it's complex. So our conversations need to be complex. We don't really live in a society that likes that. We want
a headline and a clickbait.
We want to solve the problem and watch a viral video and know we're good. And what I like to tell people is we have to keep coming at it.
Yeah.
And it's a marathon. It's not a sprint.
Yeah, that's so important. It is. And even as we round out Mental Health Awareness Month, that is not the end or the beginning of the end. It's
right.
The end of the beginning of the next round of conversations. And I think it's so important as we go through that process, when we are having more conversations, I think we're getting a little better. And I think there's a next level yet to come in terms of taking it to the next step. But talk to us for a minute just about how you see it in young people. You interact with a lot of those folks.
Right. And I would say, as I've watched my own children, I'm a new empty nester as of 2 days ago, like officially.
The fact that you're standing is a
win. I know. This is good for my mental health to have like a normalcy conversation and opportunity. I think for our kids, they are navigating big things just like we are as adults, but they're doing it without a full frontal cortex and hormone changes. And those two things, I think, impact us as adults, but we understand it in a different way because we have some longevity.
Yeah.
So I would say, as you talk with your teenagers, and I would unfortunately like to even shout out, we're talking 5 and 6 year old parents that I'm hearing from that are having thoughts of suicidal ideation and self-harm. With social media, I know it has a good and a bad rap. I love what Governor Cox is doing. He's really leading the way on a national stage. We do need to talk about the impact on that because as a 52-year-old woman, it impacts my mental health.
Yeah.
And I have some life experience in frontal cortex to kind of say, you know what, maybe I'm not, this isn't an effective use of my time right now because I'm super vulnerable in these areas.
Yeah.
So I'd say as we approach summer, what a perfect time to just maybe you don't want to be all or nothing about it with your kids. But screen time and specifically social media, can we use summer as the excuse? And maybe we just put our phones away for like a summer break for a couple of hours out of the day and see. And then I would turn it back to your kids at the normal driving in the car or at dinner time. Use emojis as your benefit. So have a mental health check-in with your kids and have them check in with an emoji. And that's a fun like family group text if you
love
have kids that have phones. We sat in the hallway with our grown adult children and done that. And it's been hilarious to see because sometimes we ask the proverbial question, how are you? And we get the,
we're fine.
Or what is it? It's either good or bad. And there's so many emojis, so many emotions. So use the phone by putting it away, but then use the phone as your weekly check-in.
Doing it by choice, not by chance or default. And I love the way you described, use the summer break. I know a lot of parents think it was the summer break, so I'm going to be a little softer on their use of social media. You're saying flip the script. Use summer as the opportunity to say, let's do less of that and more of something else.
Well, I know we have listeners that are outside of the state of Utah, but Utah had had one of the hardest winters ever. And so let's just embrace the good days of sun. And literally that vitamin D and being outside is one of the greatest mental health tools that I use for my own self. And so if you can just make a family decision that for a couple hours of day, we're going to be in the light and in the day. Instead of trying to chase the dark away, let's just make intentional choices to turn up the light.
Oh, I love that. And it's so important as we lean into those conversations. My friend, former Senator Ben Sasse, who's now the president of Florida University, he had a thing in his family where it was 1 hour a day, 1 day a week, 1 week a year.
Wow.
Where they just set them aside.
Wow.
And the results were pretty stunning with his children. And I think that's a powerful way to look at it is just do it a little different and be very intentional when you are on, when you're not on, and what other conversations you're getting at.
Yes.
As we look at this area of loneliness, obviously there's been a number of studies coming out from the CDC in terms of that loneliness. We have that longing for belonging, that craving to connect. What are the things that you're seeing in that space in terms of that loneliness factor?
Well, I think we have so much information coming at us that we think we're connecting. But when was the last time you literally did what you and I are doing where we're looking at someone and having that conversation? And so not to beat the same drum, but putting down our phones and having face-to-face conversations, I think will help that. I would just say for me as a new empty nester, I've been addressing my own mental health and the quietness in our home that at many stages of mothering, I craved. But we're in this little weird window. I've talked to a few people where we're not quite yet grandparents. So the nest hasn't filled up with more of those little chatter voices. And so I talk to the dog way more than I probably should confess. And so I've been addressing my own awareness of, have we let our couple friend game kind of drop? And a lot of my friends work during the day. And so what am I doing to reach out and connect not only with others, but myself? What am I doing to be okay with the alone time? Because I think alone is not the same as loneliness.
Yes.
You can be filled in a space where there's people always around you, but you have not had a really heart-to-heart conversation with someone in a long time. And so that loneliness can creep in and you haven't actually been alone.
Yeah.
And so for me, I'm aware sometimes of, wait, I'm around people a lot. I'm pretty out there in my career life.
Yeah.
But when was the last time I felt like someone held space for me? And this is where I'm going to plug our therapists out in the world.
Yeah.
It is okay to pay someone to listen to you. It's amazing.
It's actually a good thing.
It's actually a good thing. And I always say that to me, therapy is education and we're never embarrassed about education. And so hire someone. And if you've had a bad experience with professional therapists in the past, I always say, just like a bad haircut, you go find someone else.
Yeah.
And because of COVID, we actually have resources where we can connect with therapists that don't live in our state anymore. We don't have to get a babysitter.
Right.
We can just sit in
do
our
it
phone
online.
On a lunch break and have conversation that really goes under all those surface things that if we're functioning too much in likes and clicks and we're also only texting each other, I think there's something about that that doesn't get to kind of the root, and that feeds the loneliness.
Yeah, skimming across the surface is exhausting.
Exhausting.
Absolutely exhausting. And I think it ultimately leads to that very lonely crowd.
Right.
And we've been in that space. Well, awesome. We're going to do what we love to do on this show, and we're going to stay with the conversation just a little bit longer. We're going to step aside for a quick bottom of the hour break. When we come back, more of my conversation with Gaylen Condie. You don't want to miss any of this coming up. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, we're going to stay with the question just a little bit longer today because I think it's one of the most important questions we have in our communities, in our families, in our society. And that is around mental health. As we round out Mental Health Awareness Month, we're really pleased to have in studio with us for an extra segment today, Gaylen Condie, motivational speaker, host of podcast, mental health advocate, and someone who just gets it. And so, Gaylen, as we get into this next segment, I want to talk a little bit about grief. We're rolling into Memorial Day weekend. It has a lot of different feelings. And a lot of times we just project that way back, you know, to World War II and that. But we've had so many. We just had Jenny Taylor on talking about those who have lost loved ones, whether it was a spouse, a brother, a sister, a parent in the war on terror. And you had some really interesting insight when it comes to grief and why that grief is actually an important part of mental health.
It is. I think acknowledging it and realizing that beyond death, we can experience grief with even happy changes. So say you move jobs, but it's your choice and you're excited about it. There may be some grief just in the change. Mm. Or we have this is wedding season started and we just had graduations, right? There's a lot of change that happens. Obviously, when we lose someone to death, we automatically, as friends and family, assume someone is grieving. Mm. But I would just say, as someone that has gone through grief process multiple times on multiple levels, and recently just having our youngest leave for 18 months, I'm grieving, even though my brain is saying, I'm happy that she's happy and she chose this and she's excited. And so I have a friend that's a therapist that checked on me this week. And she said the greatest thing. I said, my head and my heart are wrestling right now. And I think that's a common experience with grief, is where your brain is trying to make sense of this maybe unexpected trauma or this loss. And she said, grief signals what you value.
Mm.
And I just, like, even saying it, it makes me feel the emotion well up, because of course I'm grieving the access to my daughter in the way that I once had for 19 years because she's not in my home anymore. And then she went on to give me counsel that we can use these skills and we've talked about it a lot this month with mental health awareness.
Yeah.
What are your resiliency skills? How do you navigate grief or loss? How do you navigate maybe the unexpected losses that just sneak up on you and all of a sudden you find yourself in a mental health need that maybe previously you hadn't? Those skills are important, and it's the functioning that sometimes I can do too much of, where I don't allow the grief to just flow through my body. Yeah. and it shows up at the unexpected times. When my sister died by suicide 9 years ago, I remember thinking as I was walking through Target one day, like, why is everyone acting normal? This doesn't feel normal. Nothing feels normal in my world. And yet it looked like everyone around me was functioning very normally.
Yeah.
But when it comes to grief, I think that's a common human experience. We're all going to experience it in some way, whether it's death of a loved one or it's just change, even if it's a change that we really value and love.
Yeah. And I just love that. Grief reveals what you really value.
Yes.
That is such an important concept for us to get to. And I just want to remind everyone, if you do have someone in your world that is struggling, that does need some help or is in crisis, remember the 988 number, anytime, any day, anywhere you have access. And the important thing is to reach out. And if you know someone who's struggling, we all need to reach out. Mm-hmm. This is a team game,
right?
For sure.
And I like to say that all of us have a mental health need, and so we need to stop thinking that there's a demographic that's our mental health concern, and the rest of us are fine. Let's just assume that we all
we're
need
all messy.
To know. And the 988 number is to me a game changer. I had a friend reach out a few months ago, and I happened to be in studio taping one of my shows, and I couldn't. You know, silence the phone, put it away. Mm. I picked it up in between tapings and she was in crisis and she has skills and she knows the research and she had to reach out to that number and it was super effective for her just to get through that 24-hour period. But for those of your listeners that are on the chronic side of things, for my sister, it was a lifetime battle.
Yeah.
That intervention needs to be more intentional and maybe long term.
Yeah.
But the 988 number, I think, don't assume that not all of us need to have that repeated and repeated. I don't know what the statistics are. How many times do you have to hear something before it sticks? 988, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like you're never alone because of the 988 number.
Yeah, fantastic. I want to pivot just a little bit in our remaining moments because there's a group out there that we often don't talk about when it comes to mental health, and it's those dealing with chronic pain, something you and I have experienced in different ways in different seasons. But it's one that we often just don't talk about, the people who are dealing with chronic pain and what that does to a person.
So quarter one of this year was a little bit of an unexpected adventure in stewardship lists of mine. Anyone that follows me on social media knows I fell and shattered my wrist in 52 places and have now a metal plate and 9 screws. And after 30 plus years of dealing with chronic pain due to lupus, I felt like I had kind of learned to navigate that stewardship of chronic pain. But this was a pain, my physical therapist said it's the top 3% most painful injury the body can experience, which felt so validating to me. But I will say that I turned to my husband in those first few weeks as my hand was literally like not where it should be. And I said, I have a new empathy for those that deal with chronic pain. If there was a drug that could touch this, because there was no pain med that could touch it, I could easily see why long term it would be easy to slip into some addiction there.
Yeah.
Nothing was helping mine. And so that wasn't. And I don't really love that feeling of feeling out of control, but I had a new awareness. And so for those that are dealing with chronic pain, I would just say this. It changes how you see your relationships. It changes how you function and show up in the world.
Yeah.
And I would say that most people don't realize I walk around with chronic pain.
Yeah.
And so that once again goes back to don't assume.
Don't assume.
If you do have a friend or a family member that has already told you a diagnosis or already told you that there's an injury or a chronic issue, check in with them because you may think you know how they're doing, but they've learned some resiliency skills so they can high function
in
their jobs and in their community. And so I would just ask, what does support look like now, which is a really effective question to ask in lots of scenarios. Mm-hmm. But ask your friends that deal with chronic pain or illness, what does support look like? Because it's not it's, always
yeah,
obvious.
Yeah, it's so important. And I think one of the real challenges with chronic pain, I know from my experience, you sort of have this vicious three things going on. You have the current pain, whatever it is. You have the memory of past pain and how bad it was last time it got that way. And then you have this projection forward problem of, is this ever going to stop? And I can't do it. And so kind of back to your point in terms of medication and how do you handle it, you get that spot where, okay, all of a sudden you're at an 8 on the 10, pain scale. And you're thinking, okay, now what do I do? Last time I didn't do anything and this happened, it was bad. Or if I take something, then I can't go to work or I can't go to my daughter's piano recital right. Or I'm going to miss the party. And then you get into that whipsaw of back and forth. And I think one of the things that we don't talk enough about in chronic pain is that ability to be present, that mindfulness mm-hmm. practice that can help you still experience the pain. And still have that ability to function in some of those different spaces.
And I'm someone that has a regular massage therapist, and I have multiple ones that I rotate through if they can't get me in. And it hasn't always been financially easy to do that. But for me, I would say for those that are struggling, I know it's almost essential. If I try to push it more than 2 weeks, then that brain trip is not helpful, because it starts to compound.
Yeah.
And so I can do all the preventative stuff in the world, and I'm very intentional about my health. I'm very intentional about the preventative stuff. But I think for those that are dealing with the marathon race on this, it isn't helpful for me to go, oh my gosh, am I still going to be doing this 7 months from now? Yeah. This is, I don't know where I can pull from. Yeah. Where is the resiliency for that? And so there's certain things that I know I need to do, and I don't love that it's usually unexpected when it stops me.
Yeah.
And I think for those that are really navigating that long term, there's not new tools or new ideas. Right. If there were, bless all of you that are going to message me, because every time I talk openly about lupus, I get multiple messages and this is what you need to try. And I know people are well-meaning, but I've been navigating this for 32 years now.
Yeah.
And so it's been my teacher. Mm-hmm. And one of the lessons that it's taught me is that I don't take my body for granted and that I move so I can move. And that's a different why.
Yeah.
And I also have some empathy for those that are like, I've called a few of my friends that are paralyzed after my accident in January and thought, I wasn't nice enough to you. Like, I didn't know what it took to squeeze toothpaste out of the tooth.
Yeah.
Paste tube and do the most simple things to wash my hair. I needed help to do that for a few weeks. Mm. And so in many ways, I don't take certain things for granted.
Yeah.
And yet, so ask your friends that deal with chronic pain what they've learned, because sometimes that helps me get out of my own head. When someone's like, hey, can you help me? And I have to reflect back. Yeah. Oh, I have navigated a lot.
I do know how to do that.
I am doing more than I thought I could do. And I am grateful for this body. But sometimes I wish I could trade it in for 2.0 or whatever Apple is on, 14.0.
Exactly. Great insight as always. Gaynalyn Condi, love having you in the studio. Your stewardship on so many fronts is a great blessing to a lot of lives and to our community as well. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We'll step aside for one last break. When we come back, some Memorial Day thoughts as we roll into the weekend. Stick around. Final segment coming up on Inside Sources.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Welcome back. Final segment of Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. Great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson. And as we're cruising on this Memorial Day weekend, it is always on Memorial Day weekend right and proper to remember, celebrate, and commemorate those who've gone before, particularly those who died defending freedom and liberty at home and abroad. Most Memorial Day tributes focus on the deeds of heroes and heroines, what they actually did. But I think it's equally important to remember who these extraordinary individuals were and the principles that they actually believed. Their commitment to principles created the kind of resolve that was required for those heroic acts and the legacies that now continue to endure. So as you go into your weekend, as you go through the weekend, whether you're visiting a cemetery, attending a sunrise memorial service, or gathering with family, all of us should acknowledge not only the actions and achievements, but more importantly, the very principles that shaped these extraordinary individuals, what drove them and enabled them to influence others. Taking this approach will actually inspire the mind and likely lead to a reflection upon the principles that drive, shape, and empower you in your life. Ultimately, such a remembrance like Memorial Day should lead to an increased desire to use the principles that we understand and value to make a difference in our families, in our neighborhoods, in our community, and ultimately in our country. As I've said before, for far too many Americans, Memorial Day has become much more synonymous with the start of summer and a good backyard barbecue than acts of remembrance, especially remembering the principles of those that have fallen. Very few Americans are actually aware that at 3 p.m. local time on Memorial Day, all Americans are invited to pause for a national moment of remembrance. Now, take note of that. It is not a moment of silence. It is a moment of remembrance. That is very, very different. Remembering the principles and the character traits that drove acts of duty, of bravery, courage, integrity, and faith is the essence of Memorial Day. And I actually believe it's the key to the future of the country. So at 3 o'clock, a moment of remembrance, not a moment of silence. And what we remember is what actually matters. And in a world that's gone pretty soft on principles and character, I'm convinced that taking time to remember the principles that drive true devotion and action in the cause of freedom is paramount. It is only through remembering principles that today's citizens, especially our young people, can begin to comprehend the commitment and resolve of those who've gone before, those who gave the ultimate sacrifice. In fact, I'd love to go back to Abraham Lincoln and in honoring those who have paid the ultimate price. I think it's always right and proper to reference the words of Abraham Lincoln. And we often quote it. They gave the last full measure of devotion. That's important. But often missed in that is Lincoln's powerful message and his immediate pivot to the future, to all of us. Lincoln said that we here highly resolve. So this is important. At Gettysburg, Lincoln recognized that those honored dead had already done their part and passed their test. Lincoln knew that the real question wasn't about the honored dead. It was whether each of us, the living, would be highly resolved to carry out our individual duty. So rereading the final section of Lincoln's address, I think challenges all of us as Americans to gratefully remember and respect those who gave all. But then it shifts the gaze to the great task that is before us, the citizens of today. And I think it challenges every one of us to be highly resolved in a commitment to the future of freedom. So in the Gettysburg Address, continuing, Lincoln said, and listen to all these references to us. He says, "It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth." So the question of commitment is pretty simple, as Lincoln asked it, and I'll ask it now. Will each American take increased devotion to the principles that have fostered the greatest civilization the world has ever known? Will every citizen be so dedicated to the unfinished work and the tasks before us? In these challenging times, in these difficult days that we face as a nation, I think it's crucial for what our children see by what we remember. Children should never have to strain to discern their parents' commitment to freedom, nor should grandchildren have to wonder what grandparents believe or what they've committed their lives to do. Communities everywhere across this country need more highly resolved women and highly resolved men who care about creating better neighborhoods and a better nation. Somebody once said that we honor best those who have gone before by living our lives with excellence today. I think that's important for all of us to get to. Barbecues are great. Family gatherings, absolutely important. Get together as a neighborhood and a community. And this is an and conversation. The invitation for the day today is at 3 p.m. At 3 p.m. Monday, Memorial Day, that we stop and we pause, not for a moment of silence, but for a moment of remembrance. And to remember those principles that those who did give the last full measure of devotion understood and, more importantly, lived. I'm Boyd Matheson. Thanks for joining us on Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. And as always, as you go out into the world today, make sure you see something that inspires, say something that uplifts, and do something today that makes a difference.
KSL FM Midvale, KSL Salt Lake City. Listen on the KSL News Radio app and in your car at 102.7 FM. KSL News Radio, Utah's all-day companion for news.
Two friends taking pictures of the rising full moon on a summer night.
Two teenage kids doing what teenage kids do.
When a stranger with a gun and a death wish changed everything.
It was violent, it was senseless, and I will never understand it, I will never accept it.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and unfortunately, we're all too familiar with stories about how violence shatters lives. But what we rarely see is how they are rebuilt. In a new podcast, The Letter, we relive tragedy, but only so we can hear the rest of the story. The struggle to reclaim lives, the realities of grief, and the possibilities of forgiveness.
I believe in miracles. Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.